Well, good morning. We're glad that you guys are here. Welcome to Ashworth. My name is Brent. I'm the lead pastor here. And last week, we began a new series where we're trying to look at some of what we believe are the most important questions that we all struggle with. Things like, why are we here? What is our purpose? And when we really get down to it, is there really any value to our life? And value is a really good word that I want us to focus in on today, because I think at some level, normal people, right, want their lives to matter. We want to make a difference. We want there to be something that happens as a result of us being here, that the world is better because we lived. Now, is that just me, or do you guys agree with that? Anybody give me some head shaking? I realize we're kind of Baptist, but you can, yeah, okay, there's some response. Good. But just think about it for a moment. What is it that makes a life valuable? What is it that makes a life important? And beyond just the value of maybe your own life, what is the value to the person who's sitting next to you? What's the value to the person you work with? Is there value there? Where do we come up with this? And who gets to, what determines, what says where that value is and how much it is and why it's important? I mean, there are many criteria that we could come up with to evaluate the importance or the value of a life. I mean, we could talk about someone's position of power, possibly. Or we could talk about their political affiliation. Is anybody else nervous now? You're like, hold on. Ooh, hold on, what just happened? See, the reason I did this, number one, is because I thought this is going to increase the tension level in the room regardless. Whatever side of the aisle you sit on, one of these pictures makes you a little nervous this morning. Or both. There you go. Thank you. But what is interesting is I think that if we look at these two pictures, most of us in this room would find one of those people, if not both, and you would think, you know what? I wouldn't spit on you if you were on fire. I mean, we kind of look at somebody's position they hold or things that they say or tweet or their politics, and because of where they land there, we assign a value to them, and we say either you have value or you don't have value. And it would be goofy. I mean, it's goofy enough that we do this based on somebody's political persuasion, but it goes even beyond that, because we can go not just to political affiliation, but we can talk about somebody's country of birth and how we would say, does the color of somebody's skin determine the value that they have? And I realize in the 21st century, we think this is a stupid question. But it's not always been a stupid question, right? I mean, it's not always been so cut and dry where the color of somebody's skin determined their value that we attributed to them. Or maybe it's their job, where we find somebody who does a job and we go, well, who would want that job? And probably a better picture, instead of a trash collector that I could put up there, was maybe a migrant worker working in the fields of California. That job that is beneath us to do. So let's leave it for those kind of people. Anybody else just get a little uncomfortable even when I say the phrase those kind of people? We should. It should make us uncomfortable. You know, what about the homeless gentleman? The assets, the amount of money somebody has in their bank account or their retirement account. How does that factor in to the value we attribute to somebody? And then the last one here, yeah, it's those of us that speak differently. By God, we are tired of being treated less than. Can I get an amen from you out there from the South? That's exactly right. Did you like that, Amy? Switched right into that Southern, didn't I? That's a silly one. But how many times throughout the course of a day or a week are we making value judgments on people, on one of these things? The criteria that we assign to say whether somebody is valuable or not. Now, we're more sophisticated in the 21st century than to ever say it out loud, but I believe it is something that continues to be a struggle for most people here this morning, but not just those of us here in this room. I think it's also an issue around the world. There's a human struggle that says, how do we value one another? You know, so I'm not bashing Christians. I'm not bashing America. I'm not doing any of that, because what I'm talking about, this struggle of determining the value of life, isn't just here. In fact, several months ago, Pastor Stephen was sharing with me how he's from a particular tribe in Liberia. And while he's planting his church here in Des Moines, he is open to all people from all African nations and all tribes from Liberia. But there's another pastor that's come in and has started lobbing bombs at his church because this other pastor is from a tribe who believe themselves to be superior to Pastor Stephen's tribe. So he's going to people that are attending Pastor Stephen's church and saying, "Why would you stoop to that level? Why would you lower yourself to be a part of that pastor's church when he's from that tribe?" This is such a problem that the United Nations has ratified two documents in order to try to help this, to declare basic human rights. One of them was from 1948, called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And then in 1976, they brought into force what was called the International Bill of Human Rights, that is 470 pages long. I know, because I downloaded the PDF. It is incredibly long. Now, there is a really cute cartoony version that they have out there as well to help us learn how to treat each other right. Does anybody other than me just scratch your head a little bit that it takes an organization to pass a document with 470 pages in order to say people matter, that there is value to life, that we should do better? And why is it that the United Nations is doing this? And where is the church in this? And where are the people that are following Jesus? Where is our voice in all this? You see, we want value for ourselves, but we are willing to devalue others to get it. And therein lies the problem. We want things in the name of rights, and we think we cling to our rights, even if it means the indignity of other people. And we're willing to do that. So the question we have to consider today is, when it comes to ascribing worth to people, do we look to the UN to make that happen? Is it necessary to have these resolutions and laws to make it happen? Or is there something else, somewhere else, we can look to find value in our existence? To understand this, though, to understand true value and worth of others, we have to begin with that critical question of where or who. Who gets to decide? And I know on the surface that sounds like a really silly question, right? But it only takes a quick look back at history for us to realize that the who that gets to decide the value of a life is kind of important. Slavery, segregation, and the Holocaust, three simple words that we can throw out there, that each of them remind us that there is something that can go incredibly wrong when the wrong person gets to stand up and say, "Well, this is who I think is important. This is who I think has value." History is littered with these stories of people devaluing others because they believe they've got the right answer. And it only takes a generation to see what was acceptable and tolerated in one generation, like the harassment of women in the workplace, that it's now seen as horrible behavior, as it should have been labeled all along. And so as I thought about that, I thought, is our only hope to wait this thing out? To hope that maybe we've got all this figured out, we've got all the inequality, we've got all the injustice, we've got all this devaluing of one another, it's all out of our system now, and we've evolved enough to a place as a culture that, whew, we don't have to deal with that again? Or do we just have to wait and hope that one day humankind will figure it out? I don't know about you, but that kind of depresses me. Do we think we know we haven't evolved to the level that we've got it figured out? And I don't know that it's proper for us to say, "Well, let's just wait and see what happens." And as we think about this, what I find so fascinating is that when you consider the secular mentality, there really is a problem. Because in the secular mentality, they have no answer for why human life should matter. Now, they say it should, But if we're a random collection of atoms, a big, huge cosmic accident, if we believe in the survival of the fittest, then why do the poor, why do the homeless, why do the weak, why should their lives matter? Doesn't evolution just take care of that for us? Secular thought has very little to say in bringing us a really good reason for why a life should matter. And because of that, I think we have to back up and say, okay, then where does this come from? Now, I had a quote. Former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes, once said this. He said, "I see no reason for attributing to a man significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or to a grain of sand." That's the secular mentality, right? Doesn't matter. So we need to look outside ourselves, because even if you're looking for Brent to determine value, I think there's an inherent problem. Because I have my own biases. I have my own thoughts and ideas. And so do you. So we go back to that question, who gets to determine the value of a life? And today what I want us to discover is it's your value personally, and the value of the people sitting around you is not based on where you were born. It's not based on your intelligence. It's not based on the color of your skin. It's not based on your education or the balance of your bank account. It isn't even based on how good you are as a person, or it's not even based on all the really crappy things you've done throughout your life. Your value is not based on any of those things, but was determined long ago in how you were created. So to understand this, I think we have to go back to the very beginning. And when I say the beginning, I mean the very beginning. The very beginning of time and the very beginning of our Bibles. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 1. When I say the beginning, I mean the very beginning. And what I want to look at is see, how does creation give us insight into our value as humanity, as humans? In Genesis 1, we have the telling of the story of creation. In the beginning, there was nothing but God. And God decides to create, and he creates everything that we see. Now, a few years ago, I preached a message on this topic, talking about Genesis 1 and the creation account and all this. And in that message, I said, you know, one of the horrible things about Genesis 1 is that it can take our focus off what I think was trying to be communicated and really get us into debating some things that aren't as critical. And we need to not worry about timelines as much about understanding the important part of the story is that God created us, and he created us to be with him, for relationship with him. But it's in how he created us that I want to look today, because it's in how we were created that we find something very important, something that separates us from everything else God created. And so in Genesis chapter 1, looking in verses 26 and 27, listen to what it says. It says, "Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them. Here's the thing. We were made in the image of God. Now, you may have grown up in church and you think, I've heard that my whole life. But what does that really mean in the likeness of God? What it tells us is that humanity is the ultimate achievement of God's creation. That in the creation order, he saved the best for last. And women, at this point, if you want to say, well, the way I read it, God made man and the last thing he did was woman and he said, I got it right. No smart man in this room will disagree with you on that. You're good. But when this is written, when God says, I'm making man in our image, what he's saying is we aren't like the animals. We're not like the plants. That phrase, in the image of God, is not said of anything else. And it also tells us that we are not an accident. We're not that random collision of atoms that just happened to slam together one day in a proper order. That there is an intentionality with our creation, with our existence. We are supposed to be here, and we are special in how God made us. we have a special status. Now, why is that? Because I said so? No. Because we as a community took a vote and thought so? No. We have special status because God said so. And this image bearing of God is what makes us human. Now, what does this mean? What does that expression even mean? I love the Latin word too, Imago Dei. That's great, and you may have heard of that. Churches call themselves sometimes Imago Dei. And it's been something, what that phrase means, image of God. It's been debated for a long time, for centuries, millennia. It's been debated. And there's three basic ways people view this expression. And the first one is this. It's the substantive view. It basically says, it looks at us and it says, okay, how we were made imitates God. So God, some people take it to an extreme and even say God has a body, so therefore, or we have a body and that's like God, so God has a body. That's not the view that's been around the longest. That's more of a recent creation, and I don't think that's correct. But the most common idea is this. We reason, we think, we have a free will, we can know right from wrong, we're not driven by instinct. And so our intellect, our personality, our creative qualities are the things that we share with God. And you should know that for most of Christian history, this has been the predominant view. As somebody said this morning, they said, if I reflect God, it must be one of those funhouse mirrors that's squunched up and makes God look kind of funny. Is that what we're talking about? Is it our personality, our will, our creative thinking, our mind? I don't know. There's a second view that says the nature of the image of God is more relational. That we relate to God unlike anything else in creation. And so the image of God is not something that we are inherently born with or possess, but it is dependent upon us being in right relationship, particularly with God. Now, there's an interesting facet of that second view, which is this, that is that if it is the relational view, and we're going to talk about this in just a second, what happens when man sins and that relationship with God is broken? Does that mean that we no longer bear the image of God in how we live? We'll talk about that in a second. The third view is the functional view. It's not in who you are. It's not about the relationships you have. It's in what you do. So if you read that Genesis 1 passage, you go a little bit further than what we read, you'll see that man is given responsibility to reproduce and to rule. And they would say, based on your function, based on what you are due, that is what it means to be made in the image of God. So which one is it? Let me just tell you, as you study theology books, which I did a lot this week, oh my gosh, I read so much. This has been debated for thousands of years. And everybody still has their own opinion. And what I will tell you is that the more I study, the more I see that there is a little bit of truth in every one of these views. That it's not just necessarily one individual view that I believe makes up the image of God, but it has to do with who we are, the character, the personality, the thinking, the emotion, the will. Those things, I think, are a part of it. As we think about the relationship, I think that has something to do with it, but not everything. But I think it's also functional in that we were left here. We are created here, not left here, created here to do something, to reflect God as we exist here. So I think it's kind of a combination of all things, of all three. You see, because as you look at the word image in the original Hebrew, it's tselem. And it simply means a representative in physical form. We bear the image of God by representing God in the world. And if you think about the ancient culture, the ancient Eastern culture, and when this would have been written, what you will discover is that, you know, they often had idols to their gods. And these idols, they often said, were in the image of their gods. This is not just a Christian expression. This was a religious expression. If I had, you know, a golden goat on my cat on my bookshelf, I would say that golden goat was in the image of my God, whatever God that might be. And while I wouldn't think that that image could do what my deity or my God could do, and I didn't think it truly represented what my God looked like, I did think it could maybe accomplish the work of who it was representing. I mean, why else would we have it? Because there we believed that there was power there in that image. That image represented the God that I was worshiping. In fact, another idea here is when you think about the image, it was very common in the ancient East for kings when they would conquer new territories. They couldn't be everywhere at the same time, so what they would do is they would erect images of themselves, statues in other areas to represent themselves, to say, I am here, this is under my control. Now, when we bring all this stuff together, we understand that maybe a little bit of each of those three views is in play. That there is something we're called to do as we represent God in this world. There is a relational aspect to being in the image of God that means we are in relationship with Him, or should have been, or should be. And then the last one, just in how we're made, and how we think, our personality, and our creation. But the big question is though, what happened with sin? What happened with the fall? Did that destroy the image of God in us? Are we talking about something that doesn't even matter anymore? Because when sin entered the world, the image of God left us anyway. There are those that believe that. There are those that believe when Adam and Eve disobeyed and sin entered the world in Genesis 3, that we lost that image, that it was no longer a part of us. And this has also been hotly debated, and you can dig into theologians like Luther and Calvin who like to look, and you know, in our passage it had two different words. It said in the image of God and in the likeness of God. And they like to say, oh, well, those words mean two different things. They really don't. But they would like to parse that a little bit and say, well, we lost one but not the other in the fall. And I tell you, when you dig into this, it gets really boring. So I'm going to stop talking about it. But the reason I bring this up is because I think it's important. Do we continue to this day to represent the image of God in how we live? And this to me can be easily resolved because in Genesis chapter 9, which is after Genesis 3, at least in my math, there's something that is said about creation again that I think tells us after the fall, the image of God stayed. So listen to this. In Genesis 9, 5 and 6. We read this. God is speaking again. And He says, and for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God, God has made mankind. Now, obviously, God is dealing with the issue of murder. And what happens when there's a murder? And if you read the Old Testament, you realize that eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth was there not because it needed to be retributive justice necessarily, but it was a restraint justice that said, don't let yourself be given over and go beyond what was done to you. But the important part of this, it says that even after man sinned, even after there was a fall, for in the image of God, God has made mankind. Now, why would God say that if at this point in history, it wasn't true? Why wouldn't it say, yeah, God made us that way, but that's no, or why would you say it at all? Because there's an important thing here that we continue to be in God's image, that we did not lose God's image as a result of the fall. And even though there may be people that want to write, people we want to write off as lost causes and say that they're a waste of perfectly good skin, God says, let me tell you something. In all my creation, in all humanity, there is inherent worth. There is inherent value because they were all created in my image. So what are the implications? Let's run through these. What does this mean for us today? Why does this matter? First implication is this: you have value. You have value. I think that's important because we live sometimes in a day and age where we super spiritualize ourselves sometimes, and we think, oh, well, let me think less of myself. And if I think less of myself, then I don't know what we think. We struggle with self-worth. We struggle with identity. We struggle with all these things. And what I'm telling you today is that you have value. Now, I'm not saying you're perfect. I'm not saying that you haven't been a colossal screw-up at times. Maybe you have been. But what I'm telling you is that regardless of your job, regardless of your skin color, where you live and what you're done, God has created you, and your value isn't determined by any of those things. It's determined by the one who created you, period, the end. And what God says about us matters more than any of the other things we may try to say assign greater value to us. Somewhere along the way, Christians got in their mind that it's super spiritual to denigrate ourselves. I can remember growing up, and there was a song called At the Cross in the first verse. Anybody else remember this? I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget it. Did he devote that sacred head for such a worm as I? Anybody remember the worm verse? Pull out your hymnal. We've changed it now. Praise God. There is no value in beating ourselves up all the time. Now, sometimes there is conviction of sin. That's a good thing. But even then, we don't live in this position of, I'm worthless, I'm a horrible person, I can't do anything right. Don't diminish what God has said is worth something. You know, there is sin, and sin is a huge problem. And you know what? We're going to deal with that in a couple weeks when we go to this new series we're really excited about called My Bad, What Separates Us from God. That is the actual artwork there for that series. We're pretty pumped about it. But even with our sin problem, and even when God looked at us, looked at humanity and said, you are my enemy, not because God said we were his enemy. We looked at God and said, we hate you, God. We don't want anything to do with you. And even then, because of that broken relationship, God said, that's okay. I'm still going to send Jesus to the cross. I still see that you are worth dying for. And that means something. So you have value. The second thing this means to us is this. Not only do you have value, but look around you right now. You see the person sitting next to you? You see that? They have value too. You know that annoying person you work with? Not that I have one. They have value. It's hard to see sometimes, but that annoying person has value. Ryan gave me permission. He actually sent me these photos. It's all good. Don't email or text me and tell me I'm a terrible person. He was good with this. And you know what? Guys, it's not just us. It's not just men have value. Did you hear that in Genesis 1:27? Male and female, he created them in the image of God. It's not reserved for us, guys. It's men and women. And it's not just reserved for white folks. It's not just reserved for black folks. It's reserved for all people. And when we truly believe that we are created in the image of God, we will begin to see one another differently. Each person who comes across our path, we will treat with a respect, with a concern, with a kindness. If we don't, we need to ask ourselves why. The image of God is not greater in one group of people than another. And based on the Genesis 9 passage, I see something very important about being made in the image of God. And it's this. I am my brother's keeper. You are your sister's keeper. We are responsible for how we treat one another and how one another gets treated. As I was studying this week, I ran across an interesting article that highlighted just how influential this idea of the Imago Dei was to Martin Luther King Jr. As you may know, this past week remembered the 50th anniversary of his assassination in Memphis. There's a sermon that he gave, and I want to read part of it to you. Just listen to the words that he spoke 3 years before his assassination, when he was talking about just how important it is to see God in one another. He said this, he said, you see, the founding fathers were really influenced by the Bible. The whole concept of the Imago Dei is the idea that all men have something within them that God injected. Not that they have substantial unity with God, but that every man has a capacity to have fellowship with God. And this gives him uniqueness. There are no gradations in the image of God. Every man from a treble white to a bass black is significant on God's keyboard, precisely because every man is made in the image of God. One day we will learn that. We will know one day that God made us to live together as brothers and to respect the dignity and worth of every man. This is why we must fight segregation with all our nonviolent might. We don't need the United Nations to tell us there's value to life. We should be living it every day. And this idea should radically transform how we see ourselves, but also how we see one another. We can't believe in the image of God and treat somebody as if they don't matter. It just can't happen. We can't see others as dispensable. It should change how we react to that frustrating family member, that annoying acquaintance, the demanding boss, the lazy coworker, the stranger, the beggar, someone who cuts you off in traffic, the unborn child, the child in foster care, the woman who gets an abortion, popular people, unattractive people, criminals, and you. It should affect how we live. There's a third implication, and I won't spend a lot of time on this one, but it's just simply this. It means that we belong to God. When you look in the New Testament and somebody asks Jesus about taxes, it's very interesting what he does. He says, pull out a coin. He pulls out a coin. He says, whose image do you see? He says, oh, Caesar. And he says, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, but then give to God what belongs to God. Whose image? Image was on the coin? Caesar's. Whose image is on your life? We belong to God. We were created by him to be with him. As I wrap up, I just want to close with one New Testament reference because I think it's important. Because the image of God, that expression, that idea is not just limited to us. But in Colossians 1:15, we read this. It says, the Son, which is Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. When we think about what it means to be in the image of God, if we want to know what it's supposed to look like, look to Jesus. Look to Jesus. And there we will see what God intended. Yes, sin messed it up. Sin marred it. That's part of it. But we have the perfect example of what God intended human nature to be, how we should strive to live. And the closer we get to Jesus, the more we'll get to know ourselves and the more we will be how we were created to be. Maybe you've never considered your worth, where that comes from. Or maybe you've been trying to earn it or make it happen. What this message today tells us is that you don't have to. The fingerprints of God are already on your life. The next step for you is believing in Jesus, surrendering your life fully to him, get to know him, live in relationship with him, and discover what being made in the image of God is really supposed to be. Maybe you hear this message today and there are people in your life that just agitate the snot out of you. I could have put that picture of Ryan back up, but I chose not to. Just kidding. Maybe it's time to see that person in the image of God and start giving them the respect they deserve. To lose our air of superiority and begin working to ensure that everyone receives the dignity they deserve as someone created in God's image. In our message community this week, I asked them the question. It's one of the things we always ask. What's the application point? What do we want people to do? Ryan said, tell them to stand up and turn around and hug somebody who looks different from them. Okay, that's kind of funny, right? But you know, that's really not far off. Maybe it's time to build a bridge to someone who does not like you, who does not look like you, and learn to enjoy and the creativity and the diversity that all of us share, while at the same time bearing the image of God. We can't be selective in who we show dignity to. This idea should radically transform how we interact with one another and how we respond to human need. What if we took a chance and we took this seriously? What if we treated everyone as if they were made in the image of God?